We speak today about the relationship between the human right to life and the right to religious freedom. And to do that, we have three documents that will ground the conversation. The first is the U.S. Declaration of Independence of 1776. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It says that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Then there's the U.S. Constitution, signed September 1787, which proclaims in its First Amendment of December 1791 that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Then, of course, there's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris in December 1948. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is an aspirational and common standard for all peoples and nations proclaimed after the traumas and horrors of World War II. Article 3 of the Universal Declaration states clearly, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. And Article 18 declares that everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. Each of these documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, point to the natural rights of human persons. They are not proclaiming merely legal rights. They're not merely aspirational documents. Rather, they're asserting that to be human is to be endowed with reason and, therefore, self-evidently, reasonable and natural rights, which include life and the free exercise of religion. The freedoms of thought, conscience, and religion are natural and interdependent rights, and when rightly understood, they serve to elevate our conception of the meaning and purpose of human life, to ground and to help explain the goods that we recognize that are a part of this created order that we inhabit, and what this created order suggests about our origins and our destiny. The human right to life is, no question, the first and most fundamental of all human rights, but the human right to religious freedom matters too, because to be human is to pursue the truth. Today, I'm excited to speak with Ambassador Samuel Brownback, who served most recently as the United States Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. Ambassador Brownback continues to work with coalitions around the globe to promote and protect the right to religious liberty. Ambassador Brownback is currently serving as a fellow at the Center for Religious Studies at the Catholic University of America and recently taught a course there, which I was glad to be a part of, on international religious liberty. Before his appointment as U.S. Ambassador, Sam Brownback previously served as U.S. Senator for Kansas and, prior to that, 26th Governor of Kansas. Ambassador Brownback is a prolific attorney, politician, and diplomat, and we're excited to speak with him today about the importance of religious liberty, what faith means to him personally, and how all of this impacts the human right to life. I am Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law from Americans United for Life, where we advance the human right to life in culture, law, and policy. I am Tom Shakley, joined again by Ellie Jockums from Americans United for Life, and we're thrilled today to speak with Ambassador Samuel Brownback, and we're going to speak today with him about so many important issues as they relate to the human right to life and the right to religious liberty in particular. So, Ambassador, welcome.
Hey, Tom, it's great to join you and particularly to see you in this different capacity after being a professor of sorts for you or instructor anyway, and now to see you in this role. And Ellie, good to be with you as well.
It's a great program that we're privileged to be a part of at the Catholic University of America. I know our mutual friend and actually Americans United for Life alum, Bill Saunders, headquarters the MA in Human Rights Program. And it's great to have you share your wisdom on how to apply theory in practice. That was so good.
Well, I don't know about that, but I've had a lot of practice. Practice usually means you hit some and you miss some, and I've had a lot of both of them. But it was just a delight, really, to have a chance to kind of think through where we are, because whenever you present a course, you have to think through where we are on religious freedom, and then the big problems, where we hope to go. So that was fun for me.
Yeah, that's right. So let's start there, because you've thought through a lot of these things. You've seen them firsthand. Most recently, I think many people would be familiar with your appointment as ambassador for international religious freedom. Can you speak a little bit about that? What led you to that? And what were some of the highlights of that experience?
You know, I've worked on the issues of religious freedom, international religious freedom in particular, for a long period of time, since I really first went into the Senate. And then we passed the Religious Freedom Act in the Senate, and that further helped kind of solidify the issue. And I just kind of continued to work in it. And then when the Trump administration came into office, Mike Pence is we were governors together. We were in Congress together. And he reached out and asked if I would serve as ambassador at large for international religious freedom. It was a statutorily established position that I'd helped establish. And I thought, you know, that'd be great. And then the Trump administration just really grabbed this topic and said, this is a fundamental human right. If we can get this one right, we can build the other human rights out of it and build strength for the other human rights when we've seen decline in the other human rights. And we can also stop a lot of genocides around the world if we could just get this fundamental one right. And so the 100 different countries to discuss religious freedom and its importance, its decline and what we needed to do to get on the other side, its importance for security, its importance for economic growth. I think we really ended up sowing a good seedbed of people saying, you know, this one has been abused and ignored. And if we can get it right, it's one of those things that really is a counterweight to governments. Religion's one of the few things that can stand up to government, that there's enough allegiance of people and enough passion. And it's in my way of thinking, it's the human right of the soul, where the other human rights are maybe more of the mind and of the flesh, but this is the human right of the soul. So it's deep within you. It's really taken off as a global topic. We've still got a huge amount of work to do, but we just had a ministerial in Great Britain where UK government hosted it. And I think we're moving forward.
Yeah, I'm really struck by this concept because, you know, my wife and I, we were speaking just a little bit before the program. My wife and I are spending a number of weeks in Europe, in Italy this summer. And just being in Rome a few weeks ago, you know, you're struck by the history of both the Christian experience in Rome, but also the Roman Empire's kind of posture toward religious belief in general, that certainly there was the Roman religion prior to Christianity's emergence. But the Romans had a sort of a toleration for religion. They kind of practiced an alpha version, a beta version of religious freedom. They had many religions they didn't tolerate, and Christianity certainly was one of them at the start. But this has been something that has taken us thousands of years to try to get right. And it does seem like the U.S. is playing such a key role, that you played such a key role as ambassador in helping articulate what this looks like in a modern context, right? Because it's still foreign to so many regimes and in so many places.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's so abused. You know, the majority religion persecutes minority religions, or an atheistic communist government like China persecutes all religions, or you get favoritism of one group and denial of others. It just got 100 different variations of how it's persecuted. And yet the only real way it works is if it's seen as a fundamental human right of the individual that the government is required to protect, majority or minority, long as people peacefully practice it. And practice that way, it's a real avenue to growth, it's really honestly the only way the world's going to move forward as we diversify and everybody spreads out and goes different places and interacts and interrelates. The only way this is going to work is if you guarantee religious freedom for everybody, everywhere, all the time, or you will have this continued clash of civilizations, because civilizations are generally built on top of a dominant religion. And that then feeling, and that, and again, it's deep within the soul. This is a deep soul feeling, will come forward and start persecuting, and there'll be communal violence and other things if you don't guarantee and stand up and be strong for the topic of religious freedom, even for religions you don't agree with. That's a key piece of it. You may not agree with their theology, and we never discuss theology at these meetings. It's always about a fundamental human right.
Yeah, I think of the contested moment we're in right now, post-Dobbs, post-Roe, and I know I've even been surprised by some of the bombast from groups like, you know, you think of the Satanists who have come out there and said, we're going to claim a religious right to abortion, right, to try to circumvent state protections for unborn children. And I think Ryan Anderson, I mean, has been the most articulate on this issue, has kind of just laughed it off and said, you can claim that. You can say that abortion, for instance, is a religious liberty right if you're a Satanist, but that's still going to come head to head with prohibition on homicide. And so, you know, I think that's a hot button example, kind of a cutting edge example of how religious liberty plays with all the other rights, which is that it's core, it's fundamental, it relates to the human conscience, but it doesn't mean it just supersedes every other right. It doesn't mean it supersedes certainly rights like the protection of life, right?
I agree. You know, because Tom, we've had, I always say religious freedom as long as you peacefully practice your faith. So if people think I need to go out and kill somebody in the name of God, that's not peacefully practicing your faith. And people do claim that. People claim that all over the world. And you're going, well, that one doesn't qualify because you're not peacefully practicing your faith. And it would fall in the same category then of if somebody says, well, I want to claim abortion because this is killing a person. Somebody says, well, it's not a person. And you're going, okay, well, then really that is the question we need to debate, is when did you become a person? And I used to, when the embryonic stem cell debate was very heavy going on, I was in the middle of that one. And I used to ask a basic question of people. I said, everything in the United States is either a person or a piece of property. I mean, you're a person, your shirt's a piece of property, your room's a piece of property, it belongs to somebody. What is the human in the womb? It's either a person or a piece of property. And, you know, what is it? And, you know, they would never answer me on the other side, because they know if you let it live long enough, it becomes a person in everybody's eyes. But then they kind of, when you want to back up, said, okay, when did it become non-property? And they wouldn't answer it. And to me, the only way you can differentiate that is when it's differentiated genetic group, which is when the egg and sperm comes together. This is different genes. It becomes a person, and it has the attributes. Now you let it grow, it's, you know, it does well. You kill it, it doesn't do well. And then I would ask people too, I remember we would argue about biology, and we'd get these biological scientists in, and they would say, you know, life begins here, there, later on. I said, okay, fine. When did your life begin? And, you know, they'd say, well, the moment of conception, but I couldn't think then. And you're going, okay, but if you kill you then, you're not going to be here now.
That's right. Yeah, I think that focus on the logic of the position is so key. You know, so often, especially now post-Dobbs, I think of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and I think of the need to make this a reasoned, logical discussion. And when I say this discussion, I mean as much religious liberty as the human right to life, because I think they really go hand in hand. They're both core parts of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. They're both kind of core victories that came out of the horrors of both World War I and World War II. And, you know, it's like Lincoln said, I think on this issue, we're going to become all one thing or all the other. And so I love that distinction you're making there between, is it a person or is it property? I think that's so key.
That harkens back to the slave debate, too. Remember when in our Constitution, we deemed a slave to be three-fifths of a person. You know, and I was as a lawyer, I'm kind of going, I don't know what great lawyer thought that idea of, but it was just, you're kind of going, yeah, well, okay, it's not, we don't want to give them personhood status, but they kind of are a person. What, well, let's give them, but they're more than half of a person, not less than half. So let's give them 60% status, you know, and you kind of go, no, okay, that sounds like a good compromise. You can't compromise on whether you're a person or not. You're either are or you're not. And I do think, Tom, the reasoned debate and the debate done in love and the debate done concerning both the mother and the child. We've got an amendment up in front of the Kansas Constitution that's going to be in the first part of August. And the title of the amendment is Value Them Both. The mother is significant, is critical. The child is, too. And so how do you value them both? And it's not one is nothing and the other is everything. It's we've got to figure out in this society, modern society, how you value them both.
Yeah, we are currently in our summer institute at AUL. And one thing, we had a speaker come, I think it was yesterday, and they said that the most persuasive way to convince women to still have their child was not through showing the humanity of the child, like proving that, but it was rather showing the motherhood and the beauty of the gift of motherhood.
I can believe it. We're expecting our ninth grandchild, and gosh, the beauty of my daughters and daughter-in-laws as mothers is glorious. And boy, as soon as we hear that they're pregnant, we are praying for that child and we're praying for that mom. I mean, it really is a gorgeous thing. I'm sure both of you have heard or watched Mother Teresa's speech when she got the Nobel Peace Prize, and or even at the National Prayer Breakfast when she spoke there. And she just said, you know, this is a war of the mother against the child, abortion. And that's not what this is about. This is about a nurture and a beauty. And we do need to show that nurture and beauty.
So I think let's move into a discussion about what we touched on just a moment ago, which is we talked about the UN Declaration on Human Rights, but we should talk first and foremost about the American context, the First Amendment to the Constitution, American identity. You know, America's framers were fearless defenders of religious freedom. They recognized what we would today call this human right. I'm curious, Ambassador, in your view, how has religion or religious freedoms played a role in American identity? I think we think of the pilgrims, we think of those early folks who came here to escape types of persecution, but also to start a new sort of life. What's your perspective on our history?
My perspective is this is a human right that figured its way forward here, and without it, you don't have a United States of America. As you think about it, these are all colonies that came from religious countries, and religion dominated a country, and religion was a reason to kill people in a country. And you had the Quakers in Pennsylvania, and you had the Catholics in Maryland, and you had the Baptists here, and you had this group there. And religion was a key part of the identity. And so now you got these 13 colonies, all pretty religiously segregated, not probably completely, but pretty closely that way. And you're going to try to bring them together. And you think, well, how are we going to do this? Because in the old world, the world that we're all familiar with, you kill over this. This is something that people have gone to the gallows regularly for. How are we going to do this? And they said, okay, we're not going to have one national church. There will be no established church of the United States of America because we can't agree on what it would be. And number two, there'll be no limitation on the free exercise thereof. You'll be completely free to practice your faith. And the government's role is just to protect those rights. And you're going, this is genius. As political, I think it's divinely inspired. As political way forward, you can't do it another way. And they come up with this, and it's unheard of, really. I mean, there had been religious freedom around the world previously, but in the known world to the Europeans, they didn't see the way you did this. So I don't see how you have a United States of America without religious freedom and the free exercise of it.
Ambassador Brownback, in what other countries have you seen the most persecutions on religious freedom, and what has resulted?
I wish I had a short list for you, but the list is pretty long. You know, Afghanistan and North Korea stand out just for their brutality. Nigeria stands out because of the, the growth of it lately, and it's it's becoming this really hotbed. And then China stands out just because of its efficiency and breadth of it. They are at war with faith. They are using technology. They are spreading an ideology to use the technology and the ideology against religious freedom. So China has always been number one in my view screen, because the spread and the use of technology, what they're doing is what I think is probably the most harmful near-term prospect for religious persecution around the world. They are diabolical on what, and they've done it initially in the most remote parts of the world. They went after the Tibetan Buddhist first. I mean, Tibet is just really one of the most remote places in the world. You can isolate it, and they have gone hammer and tong after the Buddhists that are there. And then they took the same guy, Chen Kuan Guo, that was over the Buddhist repression, and put him over the Muslim repression in Xinjiang. And you've got a genocide in both places that have been the results. And now they're spreading it out to the Christians and Falun Gong. They've been doing horrible things to them for years. And now they're spreading the technology out to other countries of how you use the technology, the internet firewall, other things, the cameras everywhere to oppress people of faith. In many parts of China, if you're kind of basically free to do whatever you want, as long as you don't criticize the government and you don't become too faithful. And you kind of, you want to go about your life. You want to get your kids educated. You want a job, you know, fine. You start getting religious because religion's the one thing that can actually stand up to government. They can get enough adherence and enough commitment from the soul of the individual that when the government does something wrong, they will say, that's wrong. And no other entity exists that can do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned the CCP's perpetrator, orchestrator of so much of this repression. And, you know, when I first looked into his history and what they're doing, in particular, their approach to trying to neutralize religious belief as a threat to, let's say, national supremacy of the government, you know, I immediately thought of, you know, the Third Reich's Reinhard Heydrich. You know, he was one of the organizers of the Kristallnacht campaign, and he was known as the man with the iron heart. That kind of willingness to repress a core part of the human identity, you know, we touched on the idea of conscience. I'm curious, you know, do you see a kind of an intuitive clarity around the idea that religious freedom, religious liberty, comes out of human conscience, right? That it's not just, I think, of maybe Hong Kong or Taiwan or certain places where the CCP in particular might want to say these are imported things, right? They point to like the one US flag in a protest crowd and they say, look, it's being funded by the Americans. And any regime could do that with a religious belief. If it didn't originate there, they could say, this is foreign, it's interference, we should get rid of it. But it comes from human reason, right? It comes from the human heart, from conscience first.
Yeah, you know, Tom, to me, religious freedom is a God-given right. And it was one of the decisions God had to make when he created humans. Do I give them freedom to choose me or not to choose me? And he could have made us such that we didn't have freedom, but he didn't. He made us so that we could, right? We could say, I believe in God. I follow Jesus. Or we could say, I do not. And it was our choice. And so God has to make that choice. And so to me, here is a human right of the soul of the deepest order, key part, the part of our eternal destiny. And we get to choose. And no government should have the right to interfere with that. Yet you've seen governments since the beginning of mankind try to interfere with this right of a person's free movement of their soul, however they would see fit. And so to me, it's just such a beautiful, deep right. And it's one that gets just pillared and picked on and abused in so many ways because of the strength of what we're talking about. This is the human right of the soul. This is the deepest part of who you are. And you can see why people would really want to try to limit that, particularly if you're a nationalist group like the Chinese, because now we're talking about that nationalism is of the flesh and the mind, and you know it's totally built on reason. Now you're going into the soul and you're appealing there, and you're going, no. And they said, we saw this play before. We saw what happened in Poland, where the Pope shows up and he says, be not afraid. And we lost it. They know the power of this human right.
You're saying the CCP is looking at the Soviet experience.
Absolutely. Well, not only that, I mean, Poland is just classic, just absolutely classic in this. But also, one of the big delegitimizing things of the Soviet Union was their treatment of the Jews and the evangelicals. They wouldn't let them emigrate to Israel, and that became a global cause. And, well, why don't you let your Jews return to Israel? Well, one, we don't believe in God, so we don't think there's any real reason they should be going. And number two, we just want to keep them here. And it really delegitimized the regime because people around the world saw how they dealt with people of faith, of sincere faith. And they said, well, that what kind of ideology is that? And to me, that's one of the things that's really knocking at the door of the Chinese Communist Party right now, is people saying, so this is how you treat Muslims? This is what you think of Islam? If you're going to be a practicer of Islam, we're going to put you in a concentration camp. If it's what you think of Buddhists, this is what you think of Christians. And most of the world practices a faith, has an adherence to an ideology of faith. And it really, I think, undermines and delegitimizes their governance.
What were one or two of the greatest victories you witnessed or helped achieve as an ambassador?
You know, I think really elevating the topic. I said at one point in time when I became ambassador, I said, we want to make religious freedom in this administration what the last administration did with climate change. We want to put it everywhere. And some people gasped in the crowd. And by the way, I think we ought to address climate change issues. I think this is a serious topic that we need to address. But I was using that as an example to say, look, we think this is a serious topic. We think the Human Rights Project has declined because we've failed to really get our basics right. And this is one of the basics. And the administration really grabbed that. And we started holding ministerials on it. We started putting it forward in agency AID projects, Agency for International Development. We started gathering civil society groups to push it. We started meeting with religious leaders, met with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that wanted to separate from the Russian Orthodox Church. We've seen that play out, unfortunately, in a very, you know, deep way, in a very deadly way. But still, it was the yearning to be free and to organize around your own faith community the way you want to. We got a long ways to go. But I do think there's now a global movement going of people that recognize the need for this human right and indeed the requirement, or else we're going to have a lot of genocides in the world just by people separating based on religion. We'll see Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations without it.
Do you see a challenge in the kind of environment we're in now where the United States, in terms of things like church attendance, but really this is across, I think, religious belief, it seems that some of this is falling away, that there are fewer people attending church or religious services than 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. do you see or foresee a possible risk to our own ability to speak with clarity on something like religious liberty if Americans aren't kind of experiencing the fruits of religious belief themselves as much?
The thing about the United States, and Reagan said this, you know, freedom is only, the loss of freedom is only a generation away. It's something every generation has to fight for. And I think that's true of this. That's why we formed the National Committee for Religious Freedom. That was modeled after the National Right to Life movement. And we brought all faiths together. So we've got Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, all together. Again, we don't agree on theology whatsoever, but we agree on this fundamental human right. And we're forming chapters in every state to fight for this at the state level, because there is this sense of falling away. And any falling away you have in the United States gets magnified around the world. It's just like when we went with Roe and opened up the doors on abortion, made it a constitutional right, that went global. And as we close that as a constitutional right with Dobbs and make this back, take it back to the states, that makes this debate all over the world saying, okay, all right, we got to discuss again whether this is a life or not. And that's what happens here, just has such a magnification around the world.
Yeah, I think it's important to view these issues as Americans and to be proud of how we practice them at home, but to recognize that we're inextricably bound up with the rest of the world, with our neighbors, all of our neighbors, not just our allies, but that everyone's looking to us. I remember being amazed after the Dobbs decision. One of the outcomes was, just to your point, Ambassador, the EU Parliament, I'm sure you saw, voted to condemn the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to reverse Roe. And, you know, this is largely a symbolic vote. I mean, the EU Parliament obviously is not going to have anything more than a kind of a symbolic or emotional, voice on that issue. But folks in Latin America, by contrast, were enthused by this because I think it's Colombia is the only nation in the world that followed directly in the U.S.'s footsteps in terms of having a constitutional level decision about abortion. And that decision in that nation was basically pointing back to the U.S. and saying, well, the Supreme Court in the United States did it. And now that that's unraveling in the United States, if you're the International Planned Parenthood Federation, for instance, or any of their affiliates, you've got a problem on your hands. But religious liberty doesn't have that challenge because it is rooted in kind of, as you say, the human soul. So I'm curious too, just before we pivot into our kind of final section here, I wanted to really underscore, that international religious liberty, as you talk about it, seems to be as concerned with principle and policy as it is concerned with people. I mean, I think of most ambassadors, right, are there in a nation representing their country. A lot of it can be at a very high level, but you dealt with both the high level, the principles, but also, I mean, cases that dealt with one or two people trying to overcome some form of intolerance or persecution or worse, right? What was that like dealing with people, helping them on such an intimate level?
Hey, it was glorious. It was frustrating in that a lot of times we didn't get them out, but whenever you got them out, when Asia Bibi got out of Pakistan in the jail that she had been put in a death penalty for a false charge for blasphemy and apostasy. And she, we get her to freedom. During the COVID crisis, the first year I was, or the last year I was in office, we got 2,000 plus people out of prison that were religious minorities in prison because we went at governments and said, you don't want them in prison and dying because of COVID and the lack of sanitation and ventilation, because they're religious minorities. And previously we had been beaten on them about, these are just religious minorities that you've jailed just because you don't like their religion. And we got over 2,000 out. And you're just going, praise God, that we could use a crisis to get some people out of jail and also to just undermine, why you got them locked up for in the first place? These are Jehovah Witnesses. They're peaceful people, but you got them locked up because you don't like Jehovah Witnesses. And that was very encouraging. But still, you've got to move governments and societies, and you have to really move people if you're going to make the movement work. And so us to be able to get this on the radar screen of, if you want to get rid of genocide, you've got to put in place religious freedom and protection of religious minorities, because most genocides are of religious minorities, like the Jewish Holocaust, or what's taking place now with the Muslims, primarily Muslims in Xinjiang, or the Muslims in Burma, the Rohingya, just kind of goes on and on. It's generally genocides are associated with a religious minority. The Turkish genocide of the Armenian Christians, it just goes on and on.
Which itself, that's been a triumph in the sense that finally there's a lot more public recognition of that as a genocide. I know there was so much denial about that for a long time. And in any of those environments, you have an Asia Bibi or someone else who becomes kind of the symbol for the much wider problem.
It's unfortunately, it is a wide problem. I really think, though, in the work that I do, what just powers it so much are the prayers of the persecuted sitting in some jail cell somewhere, huddled in some tent somewhere or basement, just quietly practicing their faith, hoping they're not discovered. And those martyrs, and there are many of them, then become, for the Christian faith, become the seed of the church that expands. Some of the fastest growing churches, Christian churches in the world, are in China and Iran, places with some of the heaviest persecution. And people would understand the history of Christendom. They would understand that if you want Christians to thrive, you persecute them. If you want them to kind of diminish in many respects, give them money, subsidize them. That's the counterintuitive nature of the Holy Spirit acting through faith.
That's right.
What I've noticed is there's just a storming conversation around abortion and religion now. Like, a common belief is you can have your religious beliefs, but you can't impose it on me. Or what Tom mentioned earlier, some religions support abortion. And I'm in DC right now. And one thing I saw a lot was Penn saying Catholics for choice. So how do you think religious dialogue is important in the abortion debate? And is it really just one group imposing their morality on another?
I don't think it's one group imposing their morality on another. I think what the Supreme Court did in Dobbs was a triumph for the rule of law. There is no constitutional right for abortion written in the Constitution. It was made up in thin air. It was poorly reasoned legal doctrine, as the scholars from left and right have both said about Roe. This was a triumph for the Constitution. This was a triumph for the rule of law. Dobbs was. And so now you take the debate back to the states, which is where Roe had stomped on it and said, you can't do it. I'm Kansan. I was governor of Kansas. I signed 17 pro-life bills. The people of Kansas elected a legislature that wanted to restrain abortion. And that's where the decision should be, is at that level. And that's what I see. This is really a triumph. Now, it becomes messy because this is a messy democracy. And we haven't had this debate for 50 years because it's been stomped on by a bad decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now we've got to get out and let's start talking to people in hearts and minds, because ultimately, really, that's where the decision is made. You know, when you've got all the access to abortion in this country that there is, and the abortion pill that can be mailed, and movement of people, you're still back to the fundamental hearts and minds. Lincoln said, America moves by establishing a common thought. And I think we have to establish the common thought that the child in the womb is a child, and we want to protect it. And I hope we start setting some objectives, like we want to reduce the number of African-American abortions by 50% over 5 years, the number of Down syndrome abortions by 50% over 5 years. So we target, narrow in on something where a lot of abortion clinics are located in poor neighborhoods, which I think is just ghastly to me. We often kill the most vulnerable amongst us because they are vulnerable, and we don't want a child that's a Down syndrome child. You're just going, Down syndrome children are beautiful, they're gorgeous, you know, and they can live to be in their 50s easily with good early work and handling. And if you don't want that child, I understand, because it's a real challenge. But there are people that want to adopt that child. So let us put them up for adoption. And it's a beautiful choice. And it's a beautiful option. So I hope we start having discussions like that myself.
Yeah, it's so key. It's so necessary, because the moment that we're in, I think post Roe, we're seeing a lot of confusion. I wonder to what degree some of the commentary or apparent confusion we're seeing is sort of paid placement by Planned Parenthood or NARAL or others. But some of it, I know, at least some of it I've encountered on a personal level, is earnest, which is just confusion about, you know, does something like miscarriage management constitute an abortion? You know, I was talking to somebody the other day who is a person of faith, self-described, and yet he was under the impression that when he and his wife experienced a miscarriage early on in their marriage, that what the doctor did in helping ultimately the delivery of that, you know, miscarried child, that was an abortion. And so he was of the mind that, you know, he says, I'm pro-life, I'm against abortion, but we've had an abortion, and you sort of have to do a lot of work in love, in charity, to just kind of step through that experience with them and explain what is the difference between an abortion, right, where a procedure whose direct and intentional purpose is to kill the child, versus something like, you know, induced delivery of a miscarried child, where the child simply didn't survive the developmental process. It wasn't killed, and the doctor didn't go in with the intent to kill. But we're seeing that conflation. And I think in part, you know, for the same reason some people confuse things about religious liberty in order to hold it up as saying falsely, this is a threat to our way of life or the things that we want to promote.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Tom. My family has experienced miscarriages several, and this is not killing of a child. This is a child that was deceased and didn't survive the development process. And it's a sad thing. For us, it was a very sad thing, but you know, you move on forward. But I think those are actually good discussions to have. We ought to talk about that, because for 50 years, this debate has been stymied and just said no. And we haven't discussed these sort of things. We need to discuss these issues. And I think we need to have a very heartfelt discussion about it. Your point on religious liberty and being kind of stymieing debate, that's an interesting one, and that I've confronted a lot, that the LGBT community will often say that your beliefs are hurting my rights. And you know what's interesting about this is the countries in the world that are best on religious freedom are actually also best on LGBT rights. And you think about it for just a minute, it makes sound reason, and that both of them go to the dignity of the individual to choose. Now, you may not agree with their choice, but it's the dignity of the individual to choose what path that they want to choose. And that's why these didn't used to be seen as competitive rights and now increasingly have been. But they're not. These are things. And we've long found ways to accommodate people with divergent viewpoints. I think in my home state of we have a number of Amish in Kansas, a number of Amish sects don't go to school past a certain grade level. And the state required, you got to go to school. But we found a way to accommodate. This was a sincerely held religious belief. I don't want to see the Amish faith go away. I love the Amish people. I love their dedication to their view of the world and their way they raise their families and stay together. Now, I'm not Amish, and I don't plan to be Amish. But I don't want to see them go away. I want to see them be able to thrive. Same with any number of different faiths. So we can do this. We look for fights and you can find them. You can look for ways to accommodate and find it.
That's so right. Yeah. I mean, I think as we're talking about these things, keeping the dialogue alive and then moving theory into practice is so key. So I know as we come to a close, I want to highlight what you've done to continue to move this issue forward. Since you phased out as ambassador, you know, role continues to be an important one. As you said, it's still relatively new. You oversaw its creation not too many years ago. And now, you know, you've created the National Committee for Religious Freedom that launched earlier this year. And you've hosted at least one IRF summit, International Religious Freedom Summit. And you had folks from all across the political spectrum there, right? And so I think that's a big success story to my view, especially in this partisan era. But you want to tell us a little bit about what you're, both how the summit went and what you're hoping for from the National Committee?
We just had the second summit, went very well. Again, bipartisan. Katrina Lantos-Sweat is the co-chair of it. She's a Democrat out of New Hampshire, just a fabulous lady, believes in the topic heartily. Tom Lantos's daughter, some people will remember Tom as the only Jewish Holocaust survivor to ever serve in the Congress, and was a friend of mine, was an immense fighter for human rights, just dogged and determined. And we had about 1,000 people from all over the world, every different major political and religious viewpoint, all standing in favor of religious freedom. Enos Freedom, the basketball player, keynoted the last night banquet, who really, in many respects, kind of got kicked out of the NBA because of religious freedom. And he was saying, you know, the Chinese, what they're doing is wrong. And the Chinese are a big part of the NBA financial ticket. And he's not playing anymore now. But he's standing courageously for freedom. And that's what I find in this movement, people standing courageously for freedom, freedom of faith, freedom of their heart. And it's going beautifully. We'll continue to do these summits to gather together the civil society and the religious groups from around the world to be able to put forward this topic. The National Committee for Religious Freedom is a political entity in the United States, you know, as I mentioned, modeled after the National Right to Life. And we're going to stand in the fight for religious freedom and to elect people that are pro-religious freedom in the United States, to oppose people that are against religious freedom in the United States. This fundamental right in the First Amendment that you have, that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for the free exercise clause, that you have the right, that there will not be a government religion, but you have the right to practice your faith freely. And we're off and going. I hope people can look us up on the website, thencrf.org, thencrf.org, and join this fight because we've really got to preserve this fundamental right to free exercise.
It's such important work, and we're just thrilled with the work that you're continuing to do to advance it. So thank you so much, Ambassador, for that work and for speaking with us today.
Happy to do it, Tom. God bless you, and God bless the listeners.
I am Tom Shakley. Thank you for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.